From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Donald Trump is threatening to sue the New York Times over its front page story today in which two women claim that they were groped by him. Two other women today have similar stories in the Palm Beach Post and People magazine. And there are more WikiLeaks emails from the Clinton campaign, including some in which top aides make disparaging comments about Catholics. So lots going on the campaign trail with less than a month to go before Election Day. NPR political reporter Scott Detrow is covering it all and joins us now. And Scott, let's start with the Trump allegations. In every one of these stories, he allegedly makes unwanted sexual advances on women that he's just met. Now, the Trump campaign denies it all, and they say that they're going to now double down on accusing the Clintons of abusing women. What do you make of all of this?
Well, I guess what I make of it is that the ugly, accusatory, confrontational tone that we all saw in Sunday night's debate is probably going to be par for the course for the rest of this campaign. I mean, last night it seemed like there was a new accusation coming out every 20 minutes or so. It was an astounding evening to just sit there and watch Twitter and see new reports surface. We don't know what else is going to come, but we do know that, as you said, that the Trump campaign is trying to punch back here, trying to throw similar accusations at Bill and Hillary Clinton. And I think that's going to make for a very nasty final weeks of this campaign.
Well, you can hear the nastiness in some of the rallies. Let's listen here to a Trump rally in Florida yesterday. He was talking about fighting ISIS.
They are hoping and praying that Hillary Clinton becomes president of the United States, because they'll take over not only that part of the world, they'll take over this country, they'll take over this part of the world, believe me.
Definitely a much more aggressive tone on his part.
That's right. I mean, Donald Trump has built his entire career on the mantra of fighting back, that any publicity is good publicity, and that getting into a back and forth with someone usually works out for your favor. Donald Trump and his top advisors at this point think the best way to unite the Republican Party is by attacking Hillary Clinton. And they're doing that in blunt, aggressive ways. There's a lot of talk about the FBI investigation into her email server, where earlier in the campaign, when the Republican crowds would chant "lock her up" at his events, Trump would say, "No, let's just defeat her." Now he joins in and basically says, yes, Hillary Clinton should be in jail, in his opinion. So that's going to keep going. The problem is that Donald Trump needs to add to his vote total right now, if you look at the polls. And this focusing on a base message doesn't really seem to be doing that.
Let's talk about the Clinton emails that you just mentioned. There have been ongoing leaks of emails from the Clinton campaign manager, John Podesta, by WikiLeaks. And in one that's gotten some attention from 2011, Clinton aides mock conservative Catholicism and conservative Catholics. Tell us about that, or what's the most damaging thing that's come out of these emails so far?
Well, I think the biggest takeaway for me is that a lot of these emails kind of play into existing criticism of Clinton and her campaign. Let's talk about that, the Catholic exchange that got a lot of attention in a moment. But just as one example, there was another email where Clinton's press secretary, Brian Fallon, talks about being in contact with, quote, DOJ folks about Clinton's emails and about the proceedings of when to release them publicly. That fits into a central critique from Donald Trump's campaign that Hillary Clinton is cozy with the Justice Department and the FBI, and that's the reason why she was not prosecuted for this private server. Now, this was an email exchange that happened before that investigation began, and it was about a separate proceeding about the public release of those emails, but this is something you immediately saw Trump work into his stump speech and that you saw Republicans push forward. So I think there's a lot of fodder there for existing critiques. As for the exchange about Catholics,
yeah,
this is something that the Trump campaign really settled around. They had a conference call blasting the Clinton campaign, saying it was disrespectful to evangelical Christians, disrespectful to Catholics. For their part, Jen Palmieri, Clinton's communications director, who's the part of this, says she is Catholic, that she does not remember this email exchange.
Scott, a lot of people are spending a lot of times these days looking at the polls, and some are even talking about whether the House could flip to the Democrats. We've been talking about it the last couple of days. Is it a real possibility?
I think it's a real possibility that Democrats take back control of the Senate. The map has been in their favor, and we've talked about that. As for the House, it's still a really uphill climb. I think most people expect Democrats will gain some seats in the House, but they need to basically run a perfect campaign, win every single seat that's in play right now. And because of the way that most of these congressional districts were drawn in many Republican-controlled state houses, it's just very hard for Democrats to do that.
That's Scott Detrow, who is covering the presidential campaign for NPR with the latest from the campaign trail. Scott, thank you.
There's probably more coming tomorrow.
I'm sure there is.
Well, the U.S. has fired its first retaliatory shots in the ongoing civil war in Yemen. The Yemeni war has been overshadowed by the brutal civil war in Syria, but it's been going on for more than a year between two factions, the Shiite Houthis, who've taken control of the capital, Sana'a, and back a previous president, and the Sunni government forces backed by Saudi Arabia, who are loyal to the current president, now based in Aden. The U.K. and the U.S. have given some support to Saudi Arabia, but were critical last Saturday when a Saudi-led coalition attacked a funeral ceremony in Sana'a, claiming it was a mistake. But after missiles were fired at American Navy ships twice this week from Houthi shores, the U.S. took action today, taking out three Houthi radar sites with Tomahawk missiles. The BBC's May Norman is covering all of this. And May, it is pretty clear that these were retaliatory.
I think the message is clear that this was in retaliation. But from the other side, the Houthis and the former Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh have denied their involvement in this mission. So the one thing that comes out quite clearly out of this is the question of whether the U.S. is willing to be more involved militarily in this conflict in Yemen.
Yeah, and a conflict that has a new layer today. Iran, which is Shiite and backs the Houthis, has announced that it's going to be deploying some warships into these waters. Now it says this is part of a usual pirate hunting mission. But is it pretty clear that Iran is sending a signal if the U.S. escalates, Iran will escalate?
It certainly sounds like each party on each side is trying to show their muscles in this conflict. And I think for Iran, it's quite an important message to make very clear that they are willing to step up their involvement in this conflict if required. And I mean, we've seen that from all parties. We've seen it from the Saudi side. We've seen it from the American side. We've certainly seen it from the Houthi side, the Houthi rebels in Yemen. And now we're seeing it from Iran.
Well, hasn't the U.S. also been a little bit nervous about its backing of Saudi Arabia, especially after Saturday's strikes that killed not only 140 people and injured 600 that were in that funeral procession, but killed the mayor of Yemen's biggest city? It feels as if there's some nervousness on the part of the U.S. already.
The airstrike on October 8th was definitely one of the biggest and one of the worst that we've seen in this conflict. That has put a lot of pressure on the U.S. as well as the U.K. And in turn, that's putting more pressure on Saudi to not only be transparent about these airstrikes and where they hit and how they choose their targets, but also whether or not this would lead to an investigation, an independent investigation that is led by an independent party as opposed to just an investigation carried out by the Saudis themselves.
Yeah. Remind us of what's at stake here. Saudi, Yemen share a border. The state-run Saudi press agency said yesterday that it had shot down a missile fired into Saudi Arabia by Shiite Houthi rebels and their allies in Yemen. I mean, that's what's at stake for Saudi Arabia. They fear that the unrest there, the overthrow of a president and a Houthi-Shia uprising, is going to spill over into their country.
The Houthi-Saudi relations have been very tense for over a decade now. The Houthis are originally from the north of Yemen, sharing a border with Saudi Arabia. And things have certainly escalated during this conflict. But after this, the latest airstrike, which killed some Houthi leaders, the Houthis have now promised revenge. And a lot of people, even those who are not necessarily Houthis, are now saying that they are willing to go and fight Saudis because so many people have lost relatives and people they knew. And as you mentioned, you know, public figures like the mayor of the capital city. So there are loads of people there and people, especially in the capital city of Sana'a, feel very passionately about this.
Yeah. Well, so May Norman, what's the thinking about what happens here? You've got Saudi Arabia fighting Yemen, essentially, fighting the uprising of the Houthis in Yemen. And then you've got the proxy war, not really a war, but the proxy, perhaps war in waiting, you know, Iran backing the Houthis and the U.S. backing Saudi Arabia. What's the thinking about how this ends?
I mean, as you mentioned, there's so many things at play at the moment. I mean, there's the internal conflict in Yemen. There's Yemen's tense relations with its neighbor, Saudi. There's Saudi and Iran. There's the U.S. and the U.K.'s relations with Saudi. and what's at stake if they do decide to review their support for this Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. So there's so many things at play in the same time. But at the heart of it, this has to be a Yemeni solution, something that the Yemenis themselves would be happy with, because there's so many divisions inside Yemen. But unfortunately, we're running out of time. The country is on the verge of famine, and the number of civilians' deaths is just growing every day. It seems that the only solution is peace talks. But after the latest airstrike, many people say that they seriously doubt that the Houthis will return to the negotiating table.
It's May Norman of the BBC covering the latest from Yemen. May, thank you.
Thank you very much.
John is in a basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on a pavement thinking about the government. The man in a trench coat, batch out, laid off, says he's got a bad cough, wants to get it paid off.
She takes just like a woman. Yes, she does. She makes love just like a woman. How does it feel? How does it feel to be without a home?
Bob Dylan, who won the Nobel Prize in Literature for his body of work today. For as the Nobel Committee said, having created new poetic expressions within the great American song tradition. Now, there's an acceptance speech I'd like to hear. NPR arts correspondent Lynn Neary is here with her thoughts. Lynn, first, were you surprised?
I was surprised. I think everybody was surprised by this decision. You know, Bob Dylan's name has come up in recent years as a possibility. The British booking agents, Ladbrokes, are always giving him some odds. I think this year it was something like 16 to 1. But I don't think anyone really expected that Bob Dylan was ever going to win the Nobel Prize for Literature,
right.
In literature particularly.
The first American to do so since Toni Morrison in 1993. And people do seem a little divided. Salman Rushdie tweeted, "From Orpheus to Faiz, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, song and poetry have been closely linked. Dylan is the brilliant inheritor of the bardic tradition. Great choice."
Well, that's really interesting because after the official announcement, Sara Danius, permanent secretary of the Swedish Academy, gave an interview, and I thought that she gave a really interesting explanation for why Bob Dylan was chosen and where he fits in the poetic tradition. Basically, she hailed poets like Homer and Sappho and said, these are poets who expected people to listen to them, sometimes accompanied by music, and that this is, you know, poetry has always been an oral tradition, and that Bob Dylan fits into this great line of oral poetry. Yeah. But she pointed out Homer and Sappho are also read, and she contended that Bob Dylan can be read as well.
Well, and we're going to listen at least to some lyrics in a second, but there's dissenting voices. Pamela Paul, the editor of the New York Times Book Review, says, still processing Bob Dylan winning Nobel Prize in Literature, so many deserving novelists. So that gets to that point that you made. But let's talk about some of the lyrics. Here's a favorite from me. Positively 4th Street, 1965. I wish that for just one time you can stand inside my shoes. You'd know what a drag it is to see you. Love that lyric. Yours.
Well, I wanted to listen to Visions of Johanna from Blonde on Blonde. Let's listen to that and then I'll talk a little bit about it.
Okay.
Ain't it just like the night to play tricks when you're trying to be so quiet? We'll sit here stranded, but we're all doing our best to deny it. And Louise holds a handful of rain, tempting you to defy it.
Louise holds a handful of rain, tempting you to defy it. If that's not poetry, I ask you, what is? I mean, that's an incredible image. It's beautiful. And as I'm sure you've been doing, I've been going through the internet, finding people's favorite lyrics, and I came across one that I'd like to read. It's from one of his most famous songs, but when I read these lyrics, I had no idea it was from this song. Let me read this.
Go.
Yes, to dance beneath the diamond sky with one hand waving free, silhouetted by the sea, circled by the circus sands, with all memory and fate driven deep beneath the waves, let me forget about today until tomorrow. That is from Mr. Tambourine Man.
Wow. When you isolate it like that, it's no longer sort of the musty old top 40 hit.
No, it isn't. It is poetry. And read it out loud and you hear it as poetry.
Yes, to dance beneath the diamond sky with one hand waving free, silhouetted by the sea, circled by the circus sands, with all memory and fate driven deep beneath the waves. Let me forget about today until tomorrow. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to.
Bob Dylan's Mr. Tambourine Man. Lynn Neary, another that I love, Masters of War. It's hard to recapture how a song like this just catapulted onto the scene in 1963 as the Vietnam War escalating. Lyrics like, come you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind desks. I mean,
unbelievable. I remember listening to that album, Free Will and Bob Dylan. My older sister brought it home. I was pretty young, so it was interesting that I'm thinking about it now that I was listening to such sophisticated lyrics, because I have this distinct memory of sitting in my parents' house by myself listening to that album and hearing those lyrics in particular and just being stunned, honestly.
You put a gun in my hand, and you hide from my eyes, and you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won, you want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain.
I don't think anybody had really heard that kind of music before, and of course Dylan immediately became known as sort of a protest singer, which later on he sort of didn't want that mantle. He said, I'm not a protest singer. Yeah. But he was known then as a protest singer because, as you say, everything was changing then, and of course he caught that in his lyrics.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll talk just briefly about the different phases, maybe anti-war. He was a Christian singer for a while.
Right.
Rockabilly.
Right. Well, of course, as I say, he started out as things were changing socially. The Vietnam War, as you mentioned, was going on. And so his songs were very much perceived as protest songs. He was very much in the tradition of the folk singer Woody Guthrie. I mean, he emulated him. But so then later on, not too long afterwards, all of this happened in the 60s. He introduced electric rock to his music, much to the consternation of his fans, obviously.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in 1969, he came out with the album Nashville Skyline. That was country rock. He went, you know, within a very short space of time, he went through a lot of changes. And then, as you say, at a certain point, he converted to Christianity. That was a very controversial time in his career. But he always had a very serious side to his music. He always had very complex lyrics. And the Swedish Nobel Committee, in addition to citing his poetry, also mentioned the fact that he continually reinvented himself as an artist. And that's another reason that he was honored.
Yeah. Always, no matter how wealthy he became from his art, anti-establishment. I'm thinking of from Like a Rolling Stone. You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. Now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging for your next meal. Mocking of others, but also just very, withdrawn and reclusive himself.
He is very reclusive, and he, as I mentioned, for instance, very much rejected the idea that he was political. He didn't like people viewing his music as political. I think possibly one of the reasons that the Nobel Committee honored him with the award is because they very often do give the Nobel Prize to writers who use their talent and use their work to challenge the status quo politically in their countries. And so I think he is seen as being part of that tradition, which the Nobel Prize Committee has always honored those kinds of artists.
All right. Well, some people have never forgiven him for how dismissive he was of Joan Baez. That's a whole other story. But people are already weighing in with their favorites, the lyrics. I mean, it's just amazing because he's written so many songs. And so remember, leave your comment at hereandnow.org as we leave with more Bob Dylan and the thoughts of NPR arts correspondent Lynn Neary. Lynn, thank you so much.
Thanks so much. It was good to be here.
I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more.
Some more lyrics. Maggie's farm. I try my best to be just like I am, but everybody wants you to be just like them. The comments are coming in at hereandnow.org. Here's one. But I was so much older then. I'm younger than now. From My Back Pages. Here's a reminder of Blown in the Wind, a song that you may have heard so many times, but stop and listen to the lyrics. How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Let us hear from you. Hereandnow.org.
I ain't gonna work for Maggie's brother no more. No, I ain't gonna work for Maggie's brother no more. Well, he hands you a nickel. He hands you a dime. He asks you with a grin if you're having a good time. And he finds you every time you slam the door. I ain't gonna work for Maggie's brother no more.
And there's been a sad development this week in a high-profile rape case against NBA star Derrick Rose. A detective investigating the case committed suicide at her home in a Los Angeles suburb. Now, the LAPD said yesterday that the detective's death was not related to her case work, but the news was a shock to those involved with the trial, which has been, well, tough. Let's listen. Let's get the latest from Here and Now. Sports analyst Mike Pesca, who also hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. And Mike, we should say first, a lot of lurid details here. We are talking about a rape charge, so a warning there to our listeners. But remind us, Derrick Rose, star player, New York Knicks, accused of rape by an ex-girlfriend, a civil case, not criminal. What is each side saying?
Yeah, civil case, not criminal. Although one of the Rose's lawyers, and I think the judge agrees with this, said was a bit of a gambit in the case is that the accuser's lawyers released a document indicating that the LAPD was looking into it as a possible criminal case. Mm-hmm. And the supposition being this was meant as an intimidation tactic, that Rose's new bosses with the Knicks would be afraid of that if there were criminal charges. So, yes, Derrick Rose, a great player for the Bulls, a one-time MVP. Injured, was brought over to the Knicks. The Knicks traded for him. And when they did that, the Knicks GM, Phil Jackson, very much downplayed the seriousness of these charges, not just the seriousness in human terms, but how much it would affect the Knicks' season. And they are very serious charges, and they do seem to be taking up Rose's time, and the Knicks can't implement an offense, which might seem to be a secondary consideration given what's going on. But yeah, it does seem to be a big mess, and you could make the case that it's more than a mess. It's a horrible thing that went on.
Well, he claims it was consensual. She is saying that she was incapacitated 3 years ago and was raped. But how does the league fit into this? Because Rose testified this week about NBA advice to young players during its rookie transition program. And I was unclear whether he was trying to say that they were told to, and again, this is, we're going to be graphic here, they were told to use condoms during sex to make sure a girl did not get pregnant, a woman did not get pregnant, or they were told to remove the condoms to take away evidence of sex. What's happened here?
And we should also say, and this is just in the basis of fact and not to be too lurid, but the rape allegations are not just against Rose. It's that three men, two of Rose's friends, had sex with her on the same night. Mm-hmm. And it is true that all the leagues do a rookie symposium. And one of their messages, and they've been criticized for this, is women might be out to get you. Women might be out to get pregnant by you. Women might be out to use leverage against you. So he brought this up in the trial, I suppose, as a mitigating factor for what he was doing. Yeah. The league can't be happy with this. But at some point, the league also is a collection of its member teams, and how the Knicks, he wasn't a member of the Knicks when this happened, but how the Knicks have downplayed this also does not redound to the glory of the NBA. But what can you do if you have a team and the team sort of poo-poos these allegations and says they're not serious, and then we see the case and they seem really shocking and serious? The league sort of is embarrassed, but it's out of their control.
Yeah. Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com, the latest on the Derrick Rose rape charge trial. Mike, will follow it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The King of Thailand has died. At 88 years old, Bhumibol Adulyadet was the world's longest-serving monarch. That title now goes to Queen Elizabeth II. The White House today offered its condolences, with President Obama calling the king a tireless champion of the country's development. For more on the king, we're joined by Catherine Bowie, professor of anthropology and past director at the Center for Southeast Asian Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Catherine Bowie, the king took on many projects during his reign. Tell us about some of them.
He was most active in the 1960s and 1970s. And I think to understand the full context of King Bhumibol, one needs to understand how weak the monarchy was when he took the throne. And to understand in the 1950s, he had been living overseas. He was educated in Switzerland. So in the 1950s, he takes the throne and is in a very weak position. In the 1960s and 70s, he begins traveling overseas, visited like 23 countries, and by, I think it was 1963, starts traveling up country with poor people, ethnic minorities. This is something that the Bangkok aristocracy would have not done on their own accord. But the king and other members of the family were traveling to ethnic minority villages. I mean, this was part of the counterinsurgency, anti-communist. This is a period of the Vietnam War. Traveling to the villages, always, just about always, with a medical team if somebody was sick, making arrangements for them to receive medical care. Lots of development projects, primarily in agriculture, including something that has been a longstanding role for monarchy, namely rainmaking, and is promoting irrigation, just a lot of projects in the agricultural sector in particular.
Well, there was a line in the New York Times obituary for the king today that said he didn't care how history would remember him. Quote, if they want to write about me in a good way, they should write how I do things that are useful. And then here he is in a BBC documentary from the 1980s when he was asked what it means for him to be the king of Thailand.
In my position, I am called a king, but my duties, if you have noticed, is not the duty of a king. It's something that is quite different. I do things I think that will be useful.
I do things that I think will be useful. That same word, what did he mean by that?
Well, I think it was, you know, all of these activities that he undertook in the 1960s and 1970s, where he was visiting the rural areas, the poor villagers. I mean, the extent of poverty in those days was very serious, and he paid attention to that. And that's something that villagers of that generation still remember. That early period was very important.
That's Catherine Bowie, a professor of anthropology and past director at the Center for Southeast Asian Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for your interest in Thailand.
Now, there has been criticism of the king, and our two guests so far are restricted in what they can say about that. Jonah Fisher at the BBC because he's in Thailand, and Catherine Bowie because she travels there sometimes, and laws are very restrictive in Thailand about not criticizing the king. Joining us now is international editor for NPR.org, Greg Myrie. And Greg, we should say that you too want to be somewhat careful about what you say because NPR has a reporter in Thailand. But what can you tell us about the issues in the country, the coups, the human rights violations, and how they reflect on the king?
Thais draw this very clear, bright line. They tended to direct problems towards military rulers, politicians, corrupt businessmen. They did not blame the king for when Thailand has issues. They saw him as this great unifying force, and criticism, you couldn't legally criticize him, but genuinely they did seem not to want to criticize him. It just didn't wasn't directed toward him.
And the new king, his son, assumes the throne at a critical juncture when there's a lot of sensitive issues to discuss. What should we expect?
Well, the law is certainly not going to change. There will still be penalties and punishment for criticizing the king, so we can't expect any movement there. But I think we're going to see this critical juncture where we don't know what kind of relationship he'll have with the military rulers, with politicians, with the business elite. He spent a lot of time outside the country, living in Germany. He's been married and divorced three times. Books written outside the country have been very critical of him. So we'll have to see, because he could play a very substantial, perhaps more substantial role, and perhaps a different role than his father. And that's what we have to see, and how Thais will accept him or be critical of him.
That's Greg Myrie of NPR. Greg, thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Imagine you wake up one day and you can't smell anything. No coffee brewing, no flowers blooming. It's as if the smell switch in your brain has been flipped off. Well, doctors can prescribe steroids or nasal sprays that might help. Surgery is sometimes an option. But for many patients, a lack of smell can linger for months, maybe years. Now there's a new technique that relies on the brain relearning how to smell. Todd Bookman from Here and Now contributor to The Pulse at WHYY reports.
She's become something of a poster child for people who can't smell.
My name is Chris Kelly, and I am a person who lost their sense of smell after a virus. I'm called an anosmic.
Straight-backed and tall, Kelly, who was born in Maine and now lives in the UK, lost her ability to smell in 2012. She caught a cold, it moved into her sinuses, and then she woke up and it was just gone.
I opened my eyes, I went into the bathroom, I uncapped the toothpaste, and was immediately aware that I couldn't smell anything.
Colds and other viruses are a common cause of anosmia, but it can also be brought on by a brain injury or from nasal polyps. Aging is another factor. Different parts of the olfactory system, the complex arrangement of nerves, glands, and receptors, simply stop working. And as quickly as it's lost, some people spontaneously recover their ability to smell. But not Chris Kelly. She sought medical treatment, tried steroids. Still, nothing.
The most poignant loss for me was the loss of the smell of my children. And, you know, my children are grown now. But when I put my arms around them, I could easily recognize their smell.
Kelly says it was like every facet of her life lost a dimension. Today, though, much of her ability to smell is restored.
Can you hear me now? Good. Right. Well, thank you very much.
Kelly is here at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia, where she's leading a workshop in something called smell training. She's not a doctor, but she is an evangelist for this type of anosmia treatment.
It started out as this thing that was a chore, like flossing my teeth, and it's ended as a kind of an altered awareness.
The smell training concept is simple. Even if you can't smell anything, anosmics need to keep trying and do so in a mindful way. Spend a few minutes in the morning, again in the evening, sniffing deeply. The repeated exposure and concentration may eventually yield results. But don't expect overnight success. It can take months, even longer.
I'm not getting anything out of lavender at all. Could you smell lavender?
Mary Beth James lost her ability to smell after being hit by a car. She's here at the workshop because it's been 4 years with very few gains made.
Lavender is a no. I'm not getting that one.
Scattered in front of Mary Beth and all the other attendees are vials of essential oils, potent little jars of concentrated lavender, as well as rose, eucalyptus, lemon, and clove. There are no rules for what you smell, but those are the scents recommended by Thomas Hummel, a German ear, nose, and throat doctor and a guru of modern smell training. He's published studies showing it can work, especially for anosmics who start soon after the injury. That hope has Kenneth Lee digging his nose deep into the rose oil, dreaming of just a whiff.
You know, if you go to garden, I like gardening, but you don't smell any flowers, so...
And since flavor and smell are so closely linked, Lee's also lost the pleasure of eating. Many anosmics say everything tastes rubbery and beige. Edmund Perbitkin is an ENT doc at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, where he prescribes smell training to his patients. He says the condition can be devastating.
Smell affects so much of what we experience. It is such a potent sense. It really adds so much joy to life. And to lose it is really difficult. Folks become depressed. Folks have all kinds of problems.
So has everyone taken a break that wanted to? Anyone want to air out their nose by going outside?
Exactly how smell training can refresh the sense of smell isn't totally understood. But as Chris Kelly works the room, she tells people to treat it like they would physical therapy after an injury or stroke. With no other options, Mary Beth James is willing to give the little vials of scented oil a chance.
I want to be able to smell the turkey on Thanksgiving and the bread that I bake and the Christmas tree. So that's, I'm giving it a shot. Why not?
Why not? She says even a bad aroma would be better than none at all. For Here and Now, I'm Todd Bookman.
Well, there's one smell that people in the UK are wishing there was more of. That would be Marmite, the sticky, dark brown paste that's often spread on toast or crackers. Turns out that because of the Brexit vote and the subsequent drop in the value of the British pound, the maker of Marmite, that would be Unilever, tried to raise the price of Marmite to compensate. And Tesco, a major supermarket chain in the UK, balked at the price increase. And now there are reports, Robin, that stockpiles on supermarket shelves are running low. And people are very upset, some tweeting that this is the Brexpocalypse. And others, on the other hand, saying the end of Marmite is the most positive effect of Brexit.
Well, I wondered about that because I understand that it tastes like molasses gone bad or concentrated soy sauce.
Who wouldn't want those things,
so,
right?
If you have a better description of it, let us know.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service, where we hope they have plenty of Marmite. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.